morning. May I please court?
Take a moment, let everyone get situated in the gallery. We have some additional audience members today. The next matter on the court's calendar is State of Minnesota versus Jacob Thomas Price. We're ready for oral arguments. Would you please introduce yourself for the record, sir?
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Mark Nivold, representing Mr. Price, counsel. I have three arguments, but I don't think I'm going to get to all of them, so I'd like to start with the one that I think is the most erroneous and the most prejudicial to Mr. Price, and that is the court denying him the right to present a consent defense based on prior sexual conduct with the complainant. The court essentially, the court admitted that these factual requisites for that defense had been established, similar circumstances, but then said that this essentially applied a different rationale, even though the facts were established, and said, well, consent just doesn't carry forward for 2 years. Well, number one, that's not what Mr. Price and his attorney argued. They never said that.
There wasn't much in the way of argument. It looks like, well, all I could find was the notice of motion in motion and then a hearing on April 17th where the court sort of said, is there anything more? And it was a very truncated argument.
Yes. Just to make sure, that's the April
17th, 2018.
Well, actually, I've got December 18th, 2017.
12-18-17?
Yes, and
Okay, keep going.
Okay. So essentially, it's laid out there. But really, what the prosecutor couldn't really come up with any prejudice. He just said this is confusing. The court couldn't come up with any prejudice. He just said basically this is the prejudicial effect outweighs its probative or could outweigh its probative value. So neither the prosecutor nor the court cite any reason. The prosecutor just saying it could be confusing to the jury. That's not a reason. He has to explain why it's confusing. Really, what the prosecutor was worried about was if this evidence came in, there might be an acquittal. Well, that's not a basis for saying that it had no evidentiary value and that it didn't meet the statutory requisites. It did. So the prosecutor never gave a reason. The court not only did not give a reason, it never actually made any finding adequate to support its ruling.
Does the court have to make findings?
Well, the court has to say if he's going to keep it out, that the prejudicial effect of this or inflammatory nature substantially outweighs its probative value. Not only did the court not give a reason, the court just said it could be prejudicial. Well, there's not even a reason to support that, and there's no finding that the statute requires.
I'm a little confused because in preparing for the hearing, when I looked at the record to find the oral argument on this motion and the district court's ruling, I looked to the proceedings. Looks like it was April 17th, 2018.
That's the one I had.
Yeah, and you're referring to a different hearing. What hearing are you referring
to? Well,
let
me look in my brief to see.
There's discussion of the motion, and each side is given an opportunity to make its argument. And then the court says, it can only be admitted if the probative value of the evidence is not substantially outweighed by its inflammatory or prejudicial nature. I can't find any probative value here.
Yes, yes.
But we're talking about the same hearing.
Yes, okay. Yes, okay. Yes, yes, that's it. So
the district court's reasoning seems to be, yes, these incidents are similar, but it's 2 years ago, and just because something happened 2 years ago doesn't mean it's likely to repeat itself. This notion of, I think what the notion is that the probative value diminishes with time, and I note that the state cites in its brief a Minnesota case that kind of sets forth that concept in the context of relationship evidence, as well as a Nebraska case, which is neither here nor there. But isn't there something to that reasoning? I mean, if it was, well, this happened 2 days ago, this happened 2 weeks ago, this happened 2 months ago, this happened 2 years ago, doesn't the probative value of a prior similar incident diminish with time?
Well, that really wasn't the court's reasoning.
Well, it seems to be the court's reasoning, because the court said, you know, if I said you could use my car, you know, 2 years ago, it doesn't mean you still get to use my car 2 years later. I mean, isn't that sort of
right, but that's
the gist of it?
That's superficial, and it doesn't take into account what the finding the court had already made, that the defense had proved similar circumstances, and that was true. No one denied that there was sex before and that it was under similar circumstances. The court made that finding. Then the court says, just because I loaned you my car 2 years earlier doesn't mean consent carried forward. Well, no one was arguing that the complainant's state of mind over that 2 years was, I'm willing to have sex with this man at any point. And that's not what the defense argued. That's what the court was saying.
Just what the defense is arguing is she agreed to it before, therefore it's likely she agreed to it again.
Yes, but under similar circumstances. What the court leaves out is he's just saying she consented then, you're saying that carries forward for 2 years, and that she consented now. Well, no, that's not enough to support it, but that's not what the defense did.
I'm not sure that's what the court's reasoning was, quite frankly. I think it was more along the lines of whatever probative value that may have diminishes over time.
Well, but the court had already made a factual finding that the defense had shown similar circumstances and that the facts alleged were true, that there was the sex. The court is really not taking into account the factual findings it made. It's trying to impose a different analysis, which is just, I lent you my car 2 years ago. That doesn't mean I'm willing to do it now. What the court should have done is to take the court's analysis and try to give it some meaning. The court should have said or considered, well, if you say you told your neighbor you can I'll loan you my car because you need to get to work, your car is broken, and you need to drive your kids to school. I'll loan you my car. Now, that doesn't mean that 2 years later the neighbor can just go over and pick it up. That's essentially what the court was doing. But what we have here is 2 years later, the neighbor comes by and says, you know what, my car broke down again, I got to get my kids to school, I got to get to work. Okay, yes, then that's a similar circumstance. So there was no support for this argument that it just diminished over time because the court wasn't taking into account.
What do we take from the similar circumstance? Because you consented 2 years ago, you consent now?
Well, under the circumstances, which is they were drinking before and they each took off their own clothes, and that's what happened here. The court said it agreed with that.
Well, that's what happened here. I mean, the victim testified that she woke up and your client was on top of her. She didn't say, I took off my clothes. I mean, it's a very different version of what happened here.
Well, they...
What happened here that's similar is, in the past, they drank together and had sexual relations.
Yes.
Currently, they went out drinking together. What happened when they got to that room? There are two different versions of what happened.
Yes, but the...
You can argue, we all agree, the most recent incident, they went out drinking, they both took off their clothes and got into bed. That's not at all what she says.
Yeah, but the court had already made a finding that there were similar circumstances. So you're making a different finding, Your Honor. The court had already made one. That's the one we have to deal with, that there were similar circumstances. The court can't just say, there's similar circumstances, but I'm not going to let it in because consent...
Why not? Why can't the court say these are similar circumstances, but this happened 2 years ago, so any probative value is almost nil?
That's not what the court said. The court just said one thing about similar circumstances, ignored that, and said came up with a different rationale, which doesn't take into account that there are similar circumstances now, which the court found.
What was the purpose of wanting that in?
To show that the sex was consensual in this case. And that's why it's...
How would you do that?
First of all, you have to have consent, be raising a consent defense.
But what's the argument for why it shows the sex was consensual?
The proffer that the defense made in which the court adopted. Okay, we're drinking.
But what's the theory? Okay, this evidence comes in, and from it, what do you argue to the jury to show consent?
These are similar circumstances, and she consented before, she consented now. And again, the court didn't say there aren't similar circumstances. And the other thing is, the court never even made a finding that the prejudicial effect would substantially outweigh the probative value. They just said it could do that. Well, that's not a finding. there weren't any facts to support that.
What about the state's argument that even if this were an abuse of discretion, it's harmless because there is substantial evidence that this was non-consensual?
Well, that's for the jury to decide. I mean, how can this...
No, because yeah. On review, yeah. You have to show error and prejudice. So we could say, okay, we think the district court made the wrong ruling. We would then have to conclude that the ruling was prejudicial before we grant relief. The state has argued that the ruling, even if it was wrong, was not prejudicial because the evidence is strong and that the victim testified that she didn't consent to this. She woke up and it was happening, and she had an injury to which a sexual examination nurse testified that included a bloody discharge and an opinion that, well, if this was consensual, we wouldn't have had that sort of showing at the hospital.
Well, number one, this is a denial of a constitutional right. And you'd have to show that the denial of this evidence is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
But that's what I'm asking this, you to address. That's
yes, this like is not a strong case. You said it's a strong case. I hope you're speaking.
Well, I'm saying the state okay. has said it's a strong yeah. case, and here are the circumstances and the record on which they rely. Could you address that argument?
Yes, it was not a strong case. She engaged in flirtatious behavior earlier that evening. She was not truthful. In her testimony, you know, the other people who were involved said, well, yes, you know, you let him give you a piggyback ride on the way back. You know, you were flirting with him at the bar. She wasn't, you know, truthful about those things. She said, he asked if I could, you know, pretend to be my boyfriend. Well, no, she asked him to pretend he was her boyfriend at the bar.
Let me go back a little. And focus on the prejudice issue. If this incident had taken place 20 years before, would you agree that it'd have far less value in the case?
I think it's fair to say that the passage of time can play a role in deciding admissibility.
Okay.
But 2 years does not knock it out of contention.
Okay, but you do agree that time would...
It could.
Okay.
It could.
So what we're looking at is whether the court abused its discretion in making that determination.
Well, first of all, the court never made a finding. That's my point. The state's asking you to support a finding the court never made. The court never gave a reason as to why the prejudicial effect substantially outweighed its probative value, and the court never even said that, never even...
The words. Court said, I do find that it would be virtually no probative value. Certainly would be, could be prejudicial, and the standard has not been met.
So yes, he didn't say the probative or the prejudicial effect substantially outweighs. He didn't use the word.
At the beginning, he said evidence can only be admitted if the probative value of the evidence is not substantially outweighed by its inflammatory or prejudicial nature. So he states the standard, line 24, page 31, and... Line 15, page 32, says the standard isn't met. I'm not having a difficult time connecting those two paragraphs.
Well, he does use the word substantial when he states the standard initially, but he doesn't state it in its findings.
Well,
you don't see it.
Here's the problem I have with, and I'm following up on Judge Larkin's question. If something has zero probative value, then any prejudicial value is substantially more than zero, right? It's infinitely more than zero.
Well, how does the court, having said, I agree that you've made the threshold factual showing of similar circumstances, and then say there's no probative value?
Well, that's what he says, though.
That's just a conclusion. He doesn't...
I do not understand how a consensual encounter perhaps 2 years earlier has any probative value for something that happened 2 years later. So he's saying it has no probative value.
Well,
I'm not suggesting I agree with him, but that's the finding he's making.
Yes, but there's no support for that. He's already said, I agree that you've shown similar circumstances, and the truthfulness of that is not in question. And then to turn around and say there's no probative value, that's just a conclusion. He doesn't explain why there's no probative value. And the state never gave any reasons.
He thinks that it has no probative value because it happened too long ago.
Well, but his reasoning is flawed because he's just taking this approach that consent doesn't carry forward. She didn't have a state of mind of consent for 2 years.
Which wasn't
no one said. No one is claiming that at any point in those 2 years she would have automatically had sex had he asked.
Or that he didn't need to inquire further.
Yeah, I'm sorry?
You weren't advancing the theory that having consented 2 years ago, he needn't have determined consent on the night in question.
Well, it's relevant to show that. Yes, that's the point.
But your argument was not that because she consented 2 years ago, he needn't have obtained consent on the night in question. You weren't making that argument.
No.
You're not making it now.
No. The thing is, the court was imposing something entirely different, which is essentially saying that you're claiming that the consent carried forward. No, we're not saying. I mean, I'm repeating myself. The point is that the court didn't make any factual findings to negate the finding it already made that the factual showing had been made, and didn't give any reasons as to why the prejudicial effect substantially outweighed the probative value. Didn't even say substantially outweigh.
All right. You have made the point, right. And your time is up. You'll have 5 minutes on rebuttal.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Michael Everson. I represent the respondent, State of Minnesota. I would like to also address the issue that appellant's counsel addressed, and specifically, and I believe the panel has already picked up on this point, but the district court made a ruling on this motion, and it is in the April 17, 2018 transcript on pages 2 or 3. Again, the court says it can only be admitted if the probative value is not substantially outweighed by its inflammatory or prejudicial nature. I can't find any probative value here.
On page 2, let me stop before we get to page 3. On page 2, do you agree that the state, in arguing this, misstated the balancing that should be done by the court on lines 11, 12, and 13?
12. Substantial should be in there.
Right.
Yes.
That's wrong.
Yes.
A plain weighing of this versus that is wrong.
Correct. And I think the district court picked up on that because the district court then states substantially outweighed by its inflammatory or prejudicial nature. The court then says can't find any probative value, gives the defense an opportunity to make a brief argument, and then makes what, you know, I would term more factual findings. Well, be that as it may, there might be similarities, and I'm taking the affidavit at face value here, as the court must. I do not understand how a consensual sexual encounter perhaps 2 years earlier has any probative value for something that has happened 2 years later. And I would direct the court to the comments to Rule 112, which is the companion rule to the statute. And the appellant cites these comments in his brief. The comments include the language, obviously, the longer lapse in time between the past conduct and the date of the alleged consent, the less the probative value becomes. They then discuss there was a proposal to include a one-year limitation on past conduct, but then the committee explained a sufficient safeguard is contained in the requirement that the probative value must not be substantially outweighed by the inflammatory or prejudicial nature of the evidence. So the rule contemplates that this sort of analysis be done, where we look at whether the past conduct is simply too remote to have any probative value over the issue of whether there was consent or whether, more specifically, the victim was physically helpless in this case. And the state, again, believes that the district court got its ruling absolutely right, and it certainly was not an abuse of discretion. Now, although we strongly believe the district court was correct, I do want to make a brief harmless error argument because the panel had asked about this, and I know appellant sort of characterize this case as not being very strong. I would strongly disagree. I believe this was a very strong case. We have the victim's testimony. It was corroborated in a number of ways, including vaginal bleeding, high levels of alcohol in her blood, the testimony of multiple witnesses in the house. And just to give you a couple of examples, one of the witnesses, whose initials are ADJ, said, and I quote, she wasn't in control of herself. Quote, she was highly intoxicated. Quote, she couldn't move. She couldn't control herself. She wasn't able to walk by herself. Another witness, SK, she was drunk. She did end up being sick. She had to be helped to the bathroom. An appellant's own testimony, and this is appellant's testimony, was that she was, quote, extremely drunk, and that's on page 288. We also have the fact that ADJ and appellant discussed the fact that BD, the victim here, was drunk. And this is, again, a quote from page 151. This is ADA's testimony. I remember having a conversation with Jake. I told him BD was intoxicated and to make sure that nothing happens tonight. And he had told me, looked me right in the face and said, and I apologize for this language, but he was like, I'm not going to fuck her. She's too effed up. Okay, so there's clear understanding, a clear manifestation of understanding that she is a physically helpless person at that point. We also have the fact that after this sexual assault occurred, appellant was in a near panic after discovering that BD had left the house. He was actually outside of the house, and these were the early morning hours, 6:30 or 7 a.m., yelling her name, looking for her. And multiple witnesses in the house testified to that fact. On top of that, we have appellant's false statement to the police where he denied that anything happened. And he denied this fact multiple times. And I know there was a claim at trial that he was tired and wasn't, you know, quite awake, but when you look at what he said, he was asked multiple times, did anything happen? Are you sure? Were you maybe making out? He said no, nothing happened. Okay. That's clear evidence of a consciousness of guilt. So for that reason, even if the district court abused its discretion, which the state does not believe it did, but even if it did, this is an example of an error that would clearly be harmless.
I agree with what you said about the problems that the appellant has in the trial record, and I think you've accurately stated all of that. Here's a problem I have. If the district court was in error on the ruling, without regard to whether that's the case or not, but if it was in error, we have a complication because BD, I want to make sure I use initials, was asked on direct examination, would you describe that there was kind of an acquaintance relationship or a little bit of friendship at least? And her response is acquaintance mainly. If the ruling was incorrect, then that answer is of questionable truthfulness.
See, I don't think that's the way a jury would look at it, because what the offer of proof, which also incorporated the victim's account of what happened
from a phone call or something,
was that this was basically a one-time thing and that there had been very little contact between them in the intervening 2 years. They didn't know each other. They went to this bonfire. They both drank. This one-time thing
happened. I understand all of that explanation, and that doubtless would have been given had the ruling been different and had the evidence been admitted at trial. My concern is that standing alone and without that explanation and without the availability of the information for the defense, it sort of leaves a jury with an understanding of who these two people are in relation to one another that's inaccurate.
See, I don't think so. I think that she described their relationship, and appellant also described their relationship as they were acquaintances in high school. They saw each other from time to time.
They were acquaintances in high school, yes.
Yes, and that's roughly, I believe, when this occurred near the end. I think it was shortly after graduation, although I might be be wrong, but she talked about...
21 at the time, because they were in bars, so it was more than 2 years after high school.
It was 2 to 3 years, I guess.
Right. The incident about which appellant complains was after high school, by my figuring.
The prior sexual encounter. Yes. Yeah, I just don't see this as painting a false picture of the nature of their relationship at all. I mean, both appellant and DB agreed that they were sort of casual acquaintances, and then there was this one-time thing. They were not close friends.
Casual acquaintance can mean a number of things, and you must concede the jury would find it illuminating to know that casual acquaintances included a one-time sexual encounter. Most people, if you said, I'm someone's casual acquaintance, I think reasonable people would not assume I'd had any sexual relations with that person.
I mean, we're dealing with young people here, so I don't know that that's necessarily the case. But, this is not a case where this, the jury's verdict turned on the nature of their, relationship. They had an accurate portrayal that they were acquaintances, and that they sort of knew each other off and on over this time period. But what the issue really here was she physically helpless? And there's substantial evidence that she was physically helpless. And I just...
In that context, the state's argument wasn't that she didn't consent. The state's argument was that she couldn't.
No. She was asleep when this whole encounter happened. And I'll just kind of...
So in that sense, the whole thing, consent defense, can you even have a consent defense if someone's unconscious?
No. I mean, you can't consent, certainly, if you're not awake or you're not able to verbalize consent or lack of consent.
Let me ask you this while I've got you there. There is another argument that's made about whether this verdict was based on the oral sex or the penile penetration.
Correct.
Based on my reading of the briefs, and I haven't studied the transcript, I'm left with the impression that the state did not argue to the jury, you can find him guilty based either on the penile penetration or the oral sex. Did the state argue to the jury that it could consider the oral sex in adjudicating guilt?
I believe that was part of the state's argument here. I don't think they, I don't know if... the prosecutor specifically tied the oral sex back to, this is the penetration we're relying on.
So when you say it was part of the state's argument, it's something that the state mentioned in terms of here's the narrative of what happened.
Correct. And it's...
What I'm wondering is, did the state say, okay, here are the elements of crim sex 3 and 4. They're proved by this penile penetration. They're also proved by this oral sex.
I don't believe the state expressly said that. The state may have implied that.
I'm guessing not, because the argument from the appellant is that the state failed to tell the jury that it couldn't find guilt based on the oral sex, which is a little bit different than saying the state argued that it should find guilt based on the oral sex.
Correct. I guess I had some trouble understanding exactly what appellant's argument was with respect to the sufficiency.
Well, as I understand appellant's argument, and he can correct me if I'm wrong, but it's that under the jury unanimity case law, we don't have to have jury unanimity in this case regarding whether the counts were proved by penile penetration or the oral sex. However, although we could have a split verdict in that regard,
right,
there'd need to be proof beyond a reasonable doubt on either means of commission of the offense. And what the appellant is arguing is there's no way this oral sex could have been while she was helpless, because by her own admission, she said no before it was going to happen. And we have case law saying if somebody says no, they're capable of...
Correct. And I would disagree with that.
So his argument seems to be we should be concerned that some members of this jury thought that he was guilty based on the oral sex, when in fact that can't legally be possible because she clearly was able to communicate non-consent. Mm-hmm. So that's why I'm wondering, what exactly was the jury invited to consider when adjudicating guilt? Were they asked to find him guilty based on the oral sex?
I don't recall specifically, but what I'd like to just do is kind of outline exactly what it was that the victim testified to, because, I mean, to me, it's clear that even the oral sex happened before she said no. She testified, BD testified, she woke up the next morning, she found her clothing had been removed, a pellet was on top of her. She was in pain, including in the pubic area. She was asked, was the penis inside your vagina? She said, it was right there, not in me, but millimeters. She then testified, at that point, I tried pushing away with my arms, and my entire body felt like jello, so it didn't accomplish much. At that point, he shifted. He had his hands on my torso and stomach and moved his head down to my pubic area. At that point, I said no and pushed him away. Okay. The next page, page 123, she says, when he moved your head, or she's asked, when he moved your head down, did your mouth or any part of your body make contact with your vagina? And she said, his mouth. Okay, so as I read that, that to me is clear that this oral sex occurred before she was able to say no and push him off. Because once you push someone off, the oral sex, by definition, is done. So, I mean, I think that's one of the problems with appellant's sufficiency argument. And again, that's pages 122 and 123. You know, I don't think you can read that as I said no after he started, because she pushed him off as she said no.
But I think that's appellant's argument. She said no before it started, which would indicate she had the capability of expressing non-consent, which would mean she's not helpless under the definition in the statute and case law.
And I again, that we have a jury that had an accurate instruction as to what
Understood.
Physically helpless means. The jury found that at the time of the sexual penetration, she was still a physically helpless person.
How do we know the jury found that? That's the heart of appellant's argument. How do we know? He says we don't know that the jury based this on penile penetration. Maybe one or more based it on the oral sex, and if they did, there wasn't sufficient evidence for that conclusion.
Well, I mean, that really goes to the jury instructions. There's no jury instruction issue raised. I don't see how we tie a sufficiency argument into this claim.
It's a very unique argument,
yes.
And I understand why it's presented the way it is, because we technically don't have a jury unanimity problem. We have a sufficiency problem as to one aspect of the unanimity prong.
And again, and I see my time's expired, if I could just very briefly answer. You know, again, looking at pages 122 and 123, as well as all of the evidence in this case, including the substantial evidence that sexual penetration occurred, it's clear the evidence was sufficient in this case, and it's clear that the sexual penetration occurred before she woke up. I just don't think there's any merit to the sufficiency claim, and for that reason and all the other reasons stated in the state's brief, we would respectfully ask this court to affirm.
Thank you. Mr. Nyvold, I'm going to ask you a question just to pick up on that, because I think this is an important part of your argument. And by the way, it is sort of a high-level argument and very well done.
Thank you. Yep.
The concern I have about your argument is this. I don't read in the briefs sort of an argument that the evidence is insufficient on penile penetration. I sort of see a little bit of a concession, like, yeah, it could be okay on penile penetration, but we're not sure that it was based on penile penetration.
Yes.
And clear as day, it can't be based on oral because she said no before it happened.
Yeah.
Because I'm with you there, but my concern becomes, if it is clear, if it is as clear as you say it is, that a finding of guilt could not be based on oral sex, you seem nonetheless to be asking us to assume that the jury reached that conclusion, even though no one specifically directed them to or argued that they should. So that's the problem I'm having. I get what you're saying. You know, technically, they might have, but is there really any indication on this record that any one juror said, oh, I'm not going with penile penetration, I'm going with the oral sex, after they've been told that helpless means unconscious, can't give consent, and they've heard testimony that says she said no before it happened?
That's the problem. The state had to take action to make sure that we wouldn't be standing here asking that question. So can I say unquestionably some jurors did? No, I can't. But the thing is, they could have, and there's a good reason.
The defenses, why did the state have to take action? I mean, you argue that the state had the obligation to argue to the jury, you can't find guilt based on oral sex. You argue that the district court had the obligation to instruct the jury in accord with a special verdict so we would know. Why doesn't any of that obligation fall on your client at trial?
Well, it certainly would have been nice if defense counsel had brought that up.
And I say that only because, obviously, he doesn't have a burden, but this is in the plain error context. So I'm looking for some law or some case that says the district court had an obligation to act here. The state had an obligation to clarify this for the jury, and I'm not seeing that.
Well, I think we have two trial judges here. I mean, I think the
three.
I'm sorry. I'm
sorry. Who you left out? You.
the court had to see this coming. Okay, and in other words, just in terms of trial management, there was an obligation to do it. And the point is, the state had.
I'm going to ask you a question there because I tried a case like this. And I saw it coming because the way it was charged, there were two different subparts of like CrimSec 3. And at the time, those subparts were ranked differently on the guidelines grid. So I said to the lawyers, are we going to have a problem here? I don't want a verdict, guilty CrimSec 3. And now we're arguing which subpart, how do we sentence? Maybe we should do special verdicts. And they looked at me and said, are you crazy? Get out of our business. We've got our strategy. We don't want you mucking this up. So the concern I have with saying this is a problem the district court should have saw and fixed such that failure to do so justifies reversal kind of has to be considered in the context of how far is a district court supposed to go in terms of stepping into how people are trying their cases.
Well, I wish I could cite a case that says, yes, they have to do this. But I think it's fair to impose that on the state, and here's why. The prosecutor did not tell the jurors, alleged oral sex, you know, don't rely on that to try to find him guilty of the penetration count.
How close did the prosecutor come to saying you can find him guilty based on the oral sex?
Well, if you combine the prosecutor, he's arguing the oral sex, okay? He's not actually going and saying use it to convict of the penile penetration.
That would make a great case for you.
Yes, but he doesn't have to go that far. Number one, he knows that there's a danger that the jurors could do that, and he knows that based on the instructions the court's going to give, the jurors can do that because the court isn't giving any instruction that says don't use that oral sex to try to convict him on the penetration count. So he knows what's going on. He leaves it hanging out there, and also he has the benefit of this rule that he doesn't have to prove what type of act, whether it was oral or penile or whatever. So he's got the benefit, and he should have just said, here's what we've got to prove that, instead of leaving it ambiguous.
Why didn't the defense object to the jury instruction and say, Judge, I don't understand why you're instructing that cunnilingus is penetration, because that's not the theory of the case. It's going to create confusion.
Yes. Well,
here we are.
Welcome to my world. I'm sorry to be flip about it.
No,
but
I understand.
Believe me, I'm frustrated, but I don't think going back and raising that would have gotten me any relief in the trial court. So in view of the fact that the prosecution gets this benefit of being able to rely on whatever acts are out there, they can't just let that go, and they know that that's a danger. I'm sure the prosecutor did, because he was careful not to say rely on it, but he certainly knew that the oral sex could count as penetration. If I could say one last thing, you can't, at page 60 of my brief, I explain why you can have a consent defense in this situation. The law does allow that. State versus Clark, citing Berrios.
I recall.
Okay, thank you.
Actually, Judge Rodenberg has a question.
I have an additional question. I'll try to make it not too convoluted, but it does a little bit go to this last point. It looks like on page 285 of the trial transcript, the appellant testified and says she lay down on the bed, she began rubbing me, and I asked if I could, and she pulled down her pants or underwear, and then he describes what happened. But in finding him guilty, it seems as if the jury given the instructions they had, necessarily rejected that testimony. Isn't that true?
That his testimony that she took
right.
her own clothes off?
Yes. Had they accepted or even had a reasonable doubt about the truth of that testimony, they would have found him not guilty under these instructions.
Well, I'm not sure that that would have been determinative for the, maybe I'm not understanding the question, but I don't know how them not
if
that
a jury
they
had been instructed yeah. as they were.
Yeah.
And had they believed that testimony or even had a reasonable doubt about whether it was true, they would have had to return a verdict of not guilty, wouldn't they?
You know, I don't know how much attention they gave to that. And it's hard.
I kind of hope that they gave attention to whether this is truthful testimony, and if it is, whether that makes him not guilty of this charge. That was the essence of their task.
Well, I can't really be speculating. I mean, I don't know how we could, or I think we'd be speculating. I don't know how we can draw that much out of it. I'm sorry, I may not be following the question, but
yeah, we're good.
But I appreciate your thought, Your Honor. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you for the briefing and the arguments. Some complicated issues. We appreciate the time and attention that was provided by the attorneys. The case is submitted. You'll have our decision within 90 days. Thank you. Now, I'll note with my colleagues' permission, we do have several visitors to the courtroom this morning. Our